author of The Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Ayelet.
Hello, nice to be here.
We are speaking via Skype. You're in Tel Aviv, I'm in London, and we're talking about your fantastic debut novel, One Night Markovitch. How did you come to write One Night Markovitch?
Well, I kind of feel that the story came to me more than I came to the story. The first time I heard about it, it's a real story. I mean, there really was an operation where they sent Jewish men from Mandatory Palestine into Europe to fictively marry Jewish women and to help them escape Nazi Germany. And I heard of it by an accident. I came to visit my boyfriend's family. They live in a village. And I saw this strange house and I asked who lived there. And then they told me about this woman, this miserable woman that lived there like prisoner from a fairy tale, that she was married to one of those guys who were supposed to divorce her when she reached Israel, and that he didn't let her go when they came to the Israeli land. And I was fascinated by it. I thought, wow, that's a story that must be written.
Yes. And it was, I mean, One Night Markovitch, but it's an extraordinary story of these Jewish men who were themselves transplants from Europe, were sent back to Germany to marry. It was the only way people could get into Palestine is by being married, because it was also illegal to even get in there.
You're right. What happened was that Nazi Europe, you know, with the concentration camp, and then you have British ruling Israel and not allowing anybody in. And so the only way to get people in was to do this crazy, dangerous mission. I mean, everybody wants to get out of Europe, and you have this man going in to save women that they never met. So on the one hand, the protagonist, Malkovich, he's the sort of hero. You know, you think, what kind of man is willing to risk his life to enter Nazi Europe when everybody wants to get out just to rescue a woman he never met? But then you have this heroic character that all the history books glorify. And then you have the real everyday men. You know, they get back from this really glorious mission into everyday life, and he's supposed to just go on with his life, and he can't. And that's, I think, the moment where the fairy tales become more dark in a way.
Yes. Yes, it's sort of like Into the Woods, what happens after, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and it also tells the story of Markovitch, but also of his best friend, who is, again, you know, he is this fantastic Sabra character. You know, he's the stuff of Israeli legend, you know? You know, the fighter, the lover, but then his reality is very different even from what he knows.
Yeah, I love the idea of taking the myth and trying to go behind the scene. You know, because on front, on the stage, what you have is really the biggest show in the world. I mean, you have a country being born out of this womb of blood and fire. This is really like the manufacturer of myth.
Yes.
And then you go inside and you say, okay, so this is what's happening on the stage, but what's going behind? And then you see that this man, who's this really crazy lover, hero, fighter, is actually perhaps an impotent, not even aware of that, or that his life was much more complicated than what he allows himself to admit. I always love this moment when we look at our life and we see that what we thought that was, you know, very safe ground is suddenly filled with holes, you know?
Yes.
You fall inside.
And that's everyone, regardless of what we tell ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's always like that, but in this specific period, the period of the birth of Israel, this is really the upper surface and the lower surface. This is really the geology of the Israeli myth.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous.
And in that, what I found very interesting, because you're telling their story, you tell it from their perspective. And so Arabs are unnamed, they're just Arabs. And also, you know, because it's outsiders and insiders, and that's it. And that's how it was, and you don't tell it any different. But also, it's hysterical to me that here we are, you know, we're founding a nation, and yet it's a small village, and they have small village mentality, and they're gossipy, and they're bitter, and they're, you know, all that goes on too. You know, meanwhile, we're creating this nation, and we're out of, you know, as you say, blood and fire, and being hounded out of Europe, and fighting tooth and nail, and yet people are people.
You're so right, because I think this is exactly the irony, that, you know, the day after Israel was founded, or the day after the Second World War ended, and you have millions of people, not just in Israel, in Europe and all over the world, they wake up, the war is over, and now they have to go and buy some milk, you know, or they have to take the laundry. Mm-hmm. Because you have the big life, and then you have the everyday life, and they mix all the time. And about what you said about the Arabs, I agree with you. The people in this book are choosing to be blind about certain areas of their soul, of their life, of their nationality. And I think this is perhaps the biggest tragedy, that people who suffered so much as the Israeli people, people that suffered from the blindness of other nations, go to form their own nation and being blind to the suffering of other people. Yes. I think this is what's happening to Markovitch as a person, and I think this is the tragedy of Israel as a state.
I think you just put that so beautifully, so succinctly. But what turned you, I mean, obviously the story, you know, took fire in you, and it's written so fantastically vividly, but you wrote it in Hebrew. It's been translated, I think, because I don't read Hebrew. I actually learned Yiddish when I was little.
Ah.
I know, bizarre. Who knew?
Sure.
Yes, exactly. And all I remember now is this poem about World War II, and it's "De Leder Ret von Beze Tag, Ret Treurig und Still." So thinking about the old days. Anyway,
wow.
That's an aside. However, but obviously you speak, and I would assume read English. What is the translation, a true translation of your heart? And does it bear, you know, is it the same for you in Hebrew as in English?
I don't know, because I never read literature in English. I'm so rooted into Hebrew that for me I feel like this is the only language I can read in. It's quite embarrassing to say that my English teacher hears this and she won't like it at all. But for me it's impossible to read Markovitch in a different language. But it's always really exciting to think that this character that lives inside your mind and your heart when you write a story suddenly lives in another language.
Yes.
When I was in Germany, when the book was translated into German, I thought, you know, wow, this is so ironic to hear sentences from your own novel without being able to understand one word from it.
I was going to say, you know, out of the books I've read, it's really a powerful and exciting read. Because in some ways, you know, I mean, I do liken it to Exodus. You know, it has all the excitement and passion of these people. And one of your characters actually, you know, came from Germany and she never spoke German again. But she wrote it.
You're right, and I know many stories of it. We have many people that came to Israel right after the Second World War that decided to cut themselves completely from Europe, because Europe symbolized all the pain that they went through.
Mm-hmm.
But for these people, they cut themselves, you know, it's like cutting an organ of your body. Now, it might be, you know, an organ which is rotten, which might, ruin the whole body, but mm-hmm. it's still an organ. And these people lived their whole life in a language that they can't really communicate in, but they refuse to communicate in the language to symbolize the pain they went through.
Yeah. Yeah, another sort of willful blindness, but out of necessity.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I want to ask you about lies and blindness, and I want to ask you about your very first lie that you remember telling.
Well, one of the first lies, I guess, or more than one, but I think one of the first lies was actually about this whole myth of, like, when you're a child, you see, I'm embarrassed even now to talk about it, but when I was a child, when I grew up, to have one of your family members being a real Holocaust survivor, you know, with the number on the hand and everything, was something prestige, because these people were very honored in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was in primary school that I actually said that I have a Holocaust survivor, that my grandmother was a Holocaust survivor. And this went very well, and I invented all these really good stories because we heard all these stories, we saw it on television, and we had Memorial Day. And it went fine until the moment they asked me to bring her to class to tell her story. and no, I mean, you can laugh, but for me it was a catastrophe. I still remember how it felt. And when I came there and I asked her, and she was a very smart woman, my grandmother, so she understood what's going on. She was so furious about the idea that what for some people was the most painful reality can be for the two generation afterwards, can be just this really cool story, you know, like you have Batman and you have Superman,
mm-hmm.
and you have the surviving Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so angry. But then she came back and she gave me this notebook and she said, okay, you want to make up stories, very well, you can write them, but you don't tell them to other people as if they were the truth. I think it was a good lesson.
Yes. Well, I have to say, when I read about your first lie, I will expose my shame as well, because you're right. We remember our first kisses. We remember our, you know, all our first, you know, the first your parents, the first word you spoke, but not our first lie. And it's a very, we lie for different reasons. We lie, there's always something behind why we lie. And I remember my lie was similar to yours in terms of wanting to both, be part of the group, but also distinguish myself from it. And I told my friends, and they were seriously gullible, because I told them I was actually cold-blooded like reptiles and dinosaurs. And that, you know, I felt the cold more. See, and you laugh. but yeah, it is.
You know, it's always easier to laugh about other people's lies than yourself. Because what you said is very true, I think. It's not just the lie we tell, it's why we tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the why is always the places that we feel less comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yes, and that's what your character Markovitch has to face at a certain point, is that he's spun himself a story, and it also lies outlive their usefulness even to ourselves.
Yeah, I agree, because I think that, you know, as a psychologist, I meet many people that tell me they're, you know, the things that they're not proud of, or what other people might think is the sins or the bad deeds. And what's interesting is that people always have a story that makes it be all right, you know? It's like, I cheated on my wife, but this and this and this. Or I hit my child, but this and this and this. Like, people always have this story, these excuses that we tell ourselves, rather than to dare to look with our eyes wide open at what it is that we do to other people, or what it is that we do to ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say, I'm a big believer in calling things what they are and accepting that. and accepting that we have dark sides. We are not perfect.
RadioGorgeous.com.
But where do you go from there? As a psychologist, what do you recommend? Okay, so I can look at it, I can accept it, I can name it, I can claim it. Then what? How do you house the dark and the light and move forward?
I'll talk through the novel in a way without telling the end for your listeners that didn't read it. But I think for me, in Malkovich, it was exactly this journey. Like, he feels entitled to have this woman. He feels that nobody ever bothered to him, nobody gives a damn about him, and that he owes himself to have this woman with him. And the moment where he clearly sees what it is that he's doing to her, I think this is the moment where he realized that this woman is not an object, it's a human being. And as a psychologist and as a writer, I think that when you look at reality with your eyes wide open, then you see things. And I think that when you see things, you can change things. Not necessarily the best way, it might take time, but I think this is the crucial point, the point where you dare to look at reality in the face.
Yes, and try to live a good life.
Yeah, and you know what you said about the dark and the light, and I thought about, you know, about day, like 24 hours a day, and you have the dark and you have the light, and it's not like you make this one choice that defines you as a good person. You make numerous choices during your life, and each choice says who you are in this specific moment. And you have the moments of the dark, and you have the moments of the light, and you should be able to move between them, not to be stuck on one thing.
Fantastic. So Ayala, tell me, Waking Lions, that's your next book. What's Waking Lions about? Give us a tease, because with this start, with One Night Markovich, I'm expecting fantastic things. Not to put pressure on you, but tell us about Waking Lions.
Well, Waking Lions is a totally different story set in a totally different time. It's in contemporary Israel. And the story is about a man, an Israeli doctor, that drives home after a night shift, and he hits an Eritrean illegal refugee. And nobody's there, and he sees that he can't save the man, and he runs. It's a hit and run. He lives in there. Only to realize a few days later that the Eritrean refugee's wife was there and saw the accident. And she starts to blackmail him. And I won't say a word rather than that.
Wow. That just set off a whole train of thought in me. Because what we were just talking about, and the choices that you make, and the choices, you know, when we feel seen and witnessed, and what we are willing to house ourselves. Very interesting.
I hope. Let's stop after you read it.
Excellent. We absolutely will. Ayelet, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much, Ben.
That was Ayelet Gunder Goshen. Her book is One Night Markovich by Pushkin Press, and it is a Waterstones Book Club Summer Choice.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
This could be the saddest dust you've ever seen. Turn to a miracle. I am alive. My mind is racing. As it always will. My hands tired, my heart aches. I'm half a world away. Here in my head, swarm. Go it alone, hold it alone, hold it alone. hold on. Ho, ho, ho. Ho, lonely, deep set hollow. Half a world, half a world away. My shoes are gone, life is done. I had too much to dream. I didn't think of you. I guess that's all I needed. To go it alone and hold it alone. Hold along and hold it. Blackbirds backwards, forwards and fall. Ho, ho, ho. Oh, this lonely world is wasted. Pathetic eyes. Came up strong, shook the trees, and blew away our fear. I couldn't be here to go it alone and hold it alone, hold it alone and hold it, go it alone and hold it alone, ho, 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 go it alone. Seen, turn to the miracle. I fly, my mind is racing. As it always will, my hands tired, my heart aches, and half a world away. Go.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.